everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Support Ops Hangout. I'm your host, Chase Clements. Before we jump into all the questions that you've all been sending us, let's go ahead and introduce you or reintroduce you to the rest of the crew. So we've got Carolyn from Buffer, who is finally back in San Francisco. So how San Francisco compare? How does that compare to Hawaii? Is it better? Is it worse? Is it about the same?
That's such a hard question. I was sad to leave Hawaii, but it's very nice to be home.
That's a good safe hedge right there. Right there. And then we've got Jeff from over at Wistia. How are things out? You're done with the snow, right? Like, we can talk about weather things again.
It snowed earlier today, and it snowed yesterday. So thank you, Chase, for reminding me.
Did you ever go out and build the snow fort that you were talking about?
No, I just paid a bunch of kids to do it.
That's thinking right there.
The snow has receded. Whatever is left is just kind of like the last. It's just a couple of sprinkles. It doesn't really stick. And we're okay for it to go because snow is so great at the beginning, and then when it just sticks around past its welcome, it's really brown and gross.
It's true. It's absolutely true. All right, so this week, let's just go ahead and dive right in because we're doing a rapid fire episode. That's one where you have sent in a ton of questions. And if you've already got questions, if you're watching this live, of course, and you've got questions along the way, feel free to tweet at us or pop them in the Slack chat room or however you want to get them to us. You can get them to us and we'll try to get them answered. But yeah, it's basically one of those where we take all the questions that really don't need a full episode, a full 30, 45 minute episode, but we still want to tackle at least a little bit just to give you kind of what we're thinking about that particular one. So let's go ahead and start. We'll go with Carolyn. We'll start with you on this one. And this is kind of a round robin. We just go straight down the line and then move on to the next question. So Carolyn, this one's from Livia Alexandra. What hard skills make a potential hire stand out? Do you look for things like HTML, CSS knowledge, API skills, or things like that?
Okay. Well, none of those are necessary. Hard skills, is being a really good writer. Does that count as a hard skill?
Yeah, I think that counts.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's much more important. I mean, yeah, being able to write, to, like, communicate really well over written. But also, like, humility and excitement and all these other things, I guess, aren't hard skills. But
yeah, sorry. I mean, that's one of those where I don't mind teaching somebody, like, about the Oxford comma. That's fine. We'll work on, like, little grammar stuff like that. If I'm teaching you, like, how to string together subjects and verbs, maybe English isn't your first language and we're kind of thinking about like a hire for another language, that kind of thing. If you can't write well, then that's something we can't really teach you right off the bat. You've got to come in knowing that. Jeff, what about you? You know, Wistia deals with lots of embeds and things like that. What kind of hard skills do you look for?
I was trying to figure out how to get into the Slack chat room. What kind of hard skills do we look for? Well, yeah. The technical ability is really great because I think that just opens your mind up a bit to more creative ways to solve a problem, right? And instead of just saying like, this is how we've always done it, this is how we'll continue to do it forever, you might say like, oh, well, you know, we could build something that's way better than this. Even if you don't do it, having that mindset is really helpful. So maybe it's not necessarily just hard technical skills, but also that sort of product-y mindset, being that we're a web product. But I would agree with Carolyn that the most important thing for me, and maybe this isn't exactly what Carolyn was getting at, is that when we hire somebody and they start on their first day, if everyone else was sick or like got hit by a bus or whatever, I know it's sad, but just stick with me for a second.
I'm crying over here in my corner.
I know. I would trust our current customers to that person, and that they may have to say like, listen, I don't know the answer to your question. Like, I'm trying to do some research, but that they would do it in the way that our customers would say, we get it. And we're so glad that you're there to take care of us. So I guess I don't have a good term for that, but somebody that I tend to think when I'm interviewing them, that I would leave them in a room with my grandparents, and then I would come back and they were like best friends.
That would be the worst first email ever to send out, to be like, hey, it's my first day. The crew got hit by a bus. give me a minute.
On my first day at Emma, the whole application went offline, and I did have sort of a really funny day of them being like, well, we had all this stuff planned to teach you, but we can't, so here's your computer. It's a real thing.
And, you know, just from my perspective, with Basecamp, we don't really look for a lot of hard skills, HTML, CSS, that kind of stuff, just because we're not dealing with it. But it does depend on your company. If you're working like, I think like Chase Livingston with Automattic, you've got to know some CSS stuff going in, because you're going to get those questions from people, from your customers. If you've got a complicated product like Diana's going to kill me because I always use her as an example, but Customer.io, you've got to have some API skills. You've got to have some HTML and CSS skills going in to that job, just because it's a pretty heavily based, whatever you want to call it. There's a lot, that skill set that's required for a job with Customer.io. So again, it just depends, you know, it depends.
The only thing that I would, and this is like part of our mindset, so it's easy for me to say, but the only thing that I would challenge there is that it's very difficult to find really good technical support people who are support people, right? Yep. If you're really, really excellent technically, you have the opportunity to do a lot of different things. And you know what? Support is an excellent calling, and I want you to do it. But also just know the pool that you're choosing out of. It's not like, oh, we have a little bit more of a technical product, so I'll just go over here and get all these like technical support people. It's extremely difficult. And I get that feedback all the time. Wistia is a very technical product, and we have a lot of technical issues. So people are like, oh, you know, we'll just hire more folks who have technical experience. And I'm like, yeah, we'll do that when we meet, you know, when we meet them and we find them, we'll do that. But in the meantime, I don't think that it makes sense to just kind of give up until you find those people. I think you also should think of ways that you can provide the customer a better experience without it. I know it's a rapid fire. I don't want to get sidetracked, but I really hate when we just give up and we say like, yep, that's our only option. And we just have to keep pushing forward until that happens.
And that's where Jeff sets the topic for next week's show. all right, next one on the rapid fire list from Keenan Jones. How do you handle refunds? And he gives the example where with their company, they require a credit card on sign up, and then after the month trial is over, they automatically start charging the card. Customers still get plenty of reminders. And at the start of the trial, he says they even have to digitally sign an official contract stating that they agree to. So it's even another reminder. But after going through all that, he says they still get customers that ask for refunds. So what do you do in that kind of state? You know, you're asking for the credit card up front. Customers are well aware that you're going to start charging. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't know you were going to charge. So Carolyn, how would you handle it?
We just generally do it. You know, there's an occasional time, especially if they stopped using the product. If they said, oh, I didn't know, or I forgot, or whatever, and they're not using the product, I'm like, no question, just give the refund. Mostly because that's our belief and philosophy that that's the right thing to do. And also, secondarily, because if you don't, then they just dispute the charge and write bad things about you on the internet. Just do it. I mean, there's been occasional moments where where somebody's using a really a really high level plan, like large business plan or something, and one little thing goes wrong every month and they ask for a full refund every month, and like you start to feel a little bit taken advantage of. So in that case, then it becomes a conversation about value. And I've tried to have those conversations with customers, sometimes successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully, but 999 times out of 1,000, I would just do it.
Jeff, what about you? In that kind of case where you're asking for the credit card on the trial sign up, just straight up give them a refund?
Can you say the question again? I finally got into Slack.
Good. Will you message me how to do it?
Yeah. So your product, not maybe USD in this case, but you got a product that requires the credit card on sign up. You tell the customer plenty of times and give them lots of reminders that first charge is going to happen at the end of the trial, yet the customer still wants a refund after that first trial because they're like, oh, yeah, I forgot. So just give them a refund?
Yeah, I think it's give them a refund and then figure out why that's happening and how often that's happening. Like maybe I would find a couple of people who are recent customers and just message them and be like, did you have any idea you were going to be charged? Right. And if like you said, or somebody else said, like 99 times out of 100, that everyone's like, yeah, of course I knew. You messaged me like 10 times. Then I would find the people who didn't. And you know what I mean? Like you keep diving deeper, right? Maybe you need to like in-app message versus just relying on email or whatever. But if you really think that it's a problem with your process, then absolutely refund 100% of the time.
Yeah, for us at Basecamp, it was kind of the same thing. Basecamp Classic required a credit card on sign up when I first joined up with the team, and there were lots and lots of refunds from customers like that. And it's just pure numbers at that point. You know, you've got 6,000 new people signing up every week. A small fraction of those are going to be like, oh, yeah, I'm a debt, so I forgot that you were going to charge me, even though you tell them. It's just that's how it goes. So in those cases, give them a refund. No problem there. I would highly suggest if you can move away from that into not requiring a credit card on a trial, you're probably going to have more luck. We did an A/B test with that, and we found that we had more signups convert into paid plans without having a credit card up front. Your company might be different. Of course, your product might be different, but I would highly suggest to, you know, if you can, A/B test that and see if you can get away without requiring the credit card. Good question from Scott that just popped up since we're dealing with the refund thing. What about chargebacks? How do either of you deal with the chargebacks in your companies? And if so, how do you deal with them?
Is that the same thing as a disputed charge?
Yeah, same thing.
I just accept them. We just say, okay, and let them send the refund. And then I usually reach out to the person and say, this was the day you signed up. This was the day you, like, did you try to cancel? Like, try and learn from it. Like, were you confused about, was it hard to cancel? Like, I think sometimes people will do that instead of canceling. So I want to learn from that. Most of the time they don't write back. But yeah, if you can't learn from it, great. And yeah, we just accept them.
Yeah, it's worth a shot. See if they'll talk. What about Jeff?
So our support team doesn't currently handle those. Our ops team does. And what we do is accept the chargeback, message them to let them know that we've received it and accepted it, and then cancel the account immediately. So that our process is we don't, you know, like Carolyn was saying in the previous example, there might be somebody who every month is like, hey, I need a refund. Hey, I need another refund. Like something else has gone wrong. If you want to dispute a charge and not like work with us on it, we're just going to cancel the account because we don't want to get into that scenario where someone's like, I told you to cancel the account. You know, do you know what I mean? That's our current process.
Yeah. Basecamp side, I have no idea. Our support team doesn't deal with it. So it's one of those, I'll find out and let you know in a future episode about how we deal with that. Next one from Jamie. Had to read my notes about this one. Jamie asks, what do you say to characters that demand an ETA for a feature and won't take no for an answer? Carolyn.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. This doesn't happen that much. Not taking no for an answer, I don't know how they do that. But I don't know about not taking no for an answer, but being sad by no answer. We find that it's great to just involve them in the process. So we've had some people who've been really adamant about certain features, and so it's really useful. Those people are super passionate about that feature for a reason. So we say, hey, why don't you talk to the team that's working on that? And oftentimes they go from sort of being sad to being really excited about it because then they're involved and they've sort of they have ownership now. And oftentimes in that conversation, the engineers or the customer development person or the product person, whoever ends up on the phone, can say, like, oh, that's a really great point. Here are some of our challenges. What would you do in these situations, or how would you make these decisions? And then they're a lot more in tune to like all the complexities that go in, and they don't just feel like you're ignoring them. So I think that's what we do in those situations. It doesn't happen that much. Most of the time people are like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, you're working on it as much as you can. But yeah, just sort of learn from them would be my answer.
Yeah. Jeff, what about you? You know, you've got a customer demanding an ETA and just won't take no when you say no. Like say no to giving out that ETA.
That would just never fly.
Jeff's like, I put the hammer down. I don't
think I'd put the hammer down, but I would say I can't put myself in the mindset of someone being like, no, I demand an ETA and like, I don't know what they're going to say. Like, I'm going to cancel my subscription if you don't give me an ETA. And I'm like, well, we don't give out ETAs. It's not a good practice for anyone. I would never encourage someone on my support team to do it, so I'm not going to do it. And they're like, fine, I'm really going to cancel. And I'm like, I don't understand why that would lead you to cancel. I mean, we're just in a different place. Maybe the person who was asking this question is like a lower volume SaaS product, right? They have like, maybe they're a CSM or something and they have a stable of customers that pay them huge amounts of money. And if a customer were to leave because of that, you know, the person who asked the question would be fired or something like mm-hmm. that, right? Like they're really back up against a wall on something like that. In that case, I would go beyond conservative. I think the common wisdom for budgets is, you know, take what you've been given and like double it or something like that. Take what you think you need and double it. I would do the same thing for timeline. Like if no one is working on it at the moment, then I would probably say we're at least a year away from doing something. If they're just looking for an ETA, then just say the most conservative ETA you could possibly think of, 5 years. We're never going to work on it or something like that. And if it's really something that is that important to them that they have it immediately and you're not working on it, then they're going to leave. Like I'm not putting together why, I guess I would have to be in the scenario. I just can't figure it out.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp. It's don't ever, ever give out ETAs just because they're going to get blown and they're going to get blown by so much time. It's one of those, you know, you might think it takes a month, then that takes 5 years. I mean, there's just no way to really do really, really good estimates to the point where you could give them out to a public and have confidence in hitting those reliably.
Well, one thing that I will add is that we do get asked by what we call white glove, but our higher touch customers, the people who pay us a considerable amount of money more than the average subscription price, to be more involved to just have a better sense of the roadmap, which I think is the same, right, as an ETA for features and that kind of thing. So I'm just still trying to think through the answer to this question. And the thing that I try to do there is, and when I have talked to folks about this, is to understand why they want that, like what the what they get out of it. And a lot of times, the asking for an ETA for a feature is more about how can I communicate with my team about when we're going to get something that we need, or like how can I be better prepared when your product's going to change? Because I have to change all my training materials. I have to do this. I have to do that. And I guess it's easy to dismiss it when it's just all you're thinking is they want this feature and they want it now, and so they want you to give them an ETA. But when you can see that you make them look like you don't make them look as good, right, which is their end goal, if you're not more transparent with them about it, then it still isn't like, oh, okay, now I'm just going to tell you when everything's coming. But maybe we might work internally to say we're going to create a 2-week period, but when a feature's ready and we haven't released it, where we're, you know, sandboxing it for a certain number of customers, or we're going to set up a staging channel that has new releases on it that only, you know, a certain group of customers gets access to, or something like that. Like you just would come up with a more creative solution than having the answer be support folks just ad hoc making up roadmaps and release dates for different features. That just is a recipe for absolute disaster.
Yeah, you know, I think kind of, I can think of one time at a previous job where I got stuck in a situation where somebody that had already left the team had promised a customer a specific ETA, and I had to come back and explain to them that we wouldn't be able to meet that, and here's why we couldn't. And as long as you're open as stealing a play from Buffer's playbook here, be open and transparent about why you can't do, why you can't meet that ETA. Nine customers out of 10 are going to be all right with that. You're going to, you know, they might be upset, and you'll get one every now and then that's just crazy and flies off the handle to you and things like that. But it's better to be upfront and honest rather than just being like, oh, we need another 6 months. Oh, we need another year, that kind of thing. All right, next one from Chinua. When you support a customer, does your choice of words depend on the customer's tone, or do you try to convey a certain tone throughout all of your interactions? And we'll kick it over to Carolyn, since they're the land of, like, happy unicorn tone.
We love happy unicorn tone, but it's not always appropriate. We very much respond to the customer. There's a difference between happy unicorn tone when the customer is happy and happy unicorn tone when the customer is unhappy. And those are pretty different. Although we try and be like buffery the whole time, it's super, super relevant, how the customer came in. We have gotten feedback from people that they say, you know, I don't like all that extra stuff. Just give me the information. And I would say certain cultures over other cultures, like Americans tend to love it. And certain other, like, not to like categorize whole countries, but like certain,
just throw that generalization out there.
Yeah. Just to, you know, be, just to classify a whole group of people. But some, like, we do find that some groups like it less. But we don't change based on that information. We don't assume that just because, somebody's from a certain area that they wouldn't like it, but we do keep track of it. So if somebody says specifically in an email, I don't like all that stuff, which they do sometimes, we flag them, and then the next time they write in, it says this person prefers a more factual tone, which Colin, our support engineer, built for us, because our happiness engineer, because then we can make that person happy with and leave out the unicorns.
I love that there's a flag that's basically no unicorn talk.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Jeff, what about you? You ever change your tone like that?
MailChimp had something very similar to no unicorn tone. It was called party pooper mode.
Yeah.
It would turn off all of the like fun, helpful stuff that was written in MailChimpy language. I don't know if they still do any of that stuff. Like, Freddy has kind of disappeared into the background with the redesign, but that used to be one of my favorite things in MailChimp, was showing off the party pooper mode. Do we change tone? I don't know. You might be asking the wrong guy. We don't have any kind of process around that. People tend to... We try to hire people who can figure out the right tone to use in different situations. The things that are more likely to change are what we might. What is likely to change with someone who's like super serious?
See, this is the best part of the show. We get to see Jeff think through his answer.
Yeah. Right. It's so fun. And now that I know that there's a Slack room where people are judging everything I say, I can go in and get feedback.
That's what I mean.
No, see, this is, I hide y'all from all the reviews that come in.
I know, I so appreciate it. Well, I'm sure Scott sends me a negative one after each episode, like, you really got to fix this, Chase. I don't think so. I think that we do have one of our goals is to be useful as a product to people who have no idea what the internet is, right? For lack of a better term.
Yeah.
That we should be accessible for someone who would write in and say, like, by the way, I do not know how computers work, so don't talk to me in computer-y language. And I think there is a good amount of understanding. You need to read the situation between someone who's technical and maybe someone who isn't technical. So I think that we try to change our answer depending on that context more than we would try to change our context, our tone based on like whether this person is a super serious person or not. But still, we want to be more on the side of less technical then more technical. So even though you might change your tone, and I think Carolyn does this without saying that in her answer, but their default tone is be helpful and friendly, right?
With unicorns.
That you might be like one of the things that makes someone's day really great, right? And that's your default tone. And if you have to change, it's because Colin put in the little flag that says change. You don't change just because, you know, you're kind of feeling it. And I think that that's very important to have that default.
Yeah. From my side, my tone tends to be me. Like when you get an email from me, it sounds like me. It would just be like having a conversation in real life or on the phone or whatever with me. The only time it would change for me is when we're dealing, like Jeff mentioned, with technical versus non-technical kind of things. So if somebody says, hey, I can't log into Basecamp, every time I go to the site, it says it's down for me. And if I know for a fact it's up and running, then I'm going to talk to that person in a different way and explain how the series of tubes on the internet works differently than like if an engineer writes me and says, hey, here's my trace route to y'all. Something's getting hung up somewhere. Can you tell me where it is? Like that's two completely different tones there based on technical versus non-technical. That's probably the only difference I would make. Everything else sounds like me. And my answer is going to sound different than like anybody else on our team, like Marissa or Kristen or anybody else. It's going to be a little different just because that's how people write. Yeah.
There's also,
next. Go.
The one thing I would add to that is there's also a difference between like technical and non-technical. There's also a very big difference between new to your product and not new to your product. So like if you say, oh yeah, like if they say, I can't connect my profile, and we say like, connect your profile here. And they're like, yeah, I know. I have 16 profiles connected. What I meant was that it's not working. Like that can be really frustrating as opposed to like somebody who's brand new who probably wants to know where to connect their profile. Not like I can't connect my profile sometimes means very different things depending on how comfortable they are with your product. So that's a context thing that I think is relevant as well.
All right. Easy softball question. Jeff, what's this one comes from Shannon. What's your favorite gifts to send to your customers?
T-shirts, I would have to say. I mean, that's the one we go with most often. We don't tend to emoji. We don't tend to send a lot of gifts, I guess. Or is it gifts like GIFs?
Oh, no, don't open
if it's
that.
GIFs, I mean, we got a long list. I would say that The Office probably leads in the gifts category, but gifts. What have we done? Cookies, coffee. It's really fun to find another customer who has a cool product and send something, right? So you're buying from one customer to send as a gift to another customer, but we don't have a process around it, so I can't really say what our favorite is. I'd have to survey people. But I would say our most frequent is if somebody like sticks with me for a whole technical issue. When I was working on technical issues, I might say something like, it was really great that, you know, your eagle eyes like brought this up and that you stuck with it the whole way through. Like I would love to send you a t-shirt. It'd make me so happy to have you be like proud and touting a Wistia t-shirt. So that's probably my answer.
Carolyn, what kind of gifts are you sending out from Buffer?
We send t-shirts and stickers and moleskins. The one that I think is my favorite is to gift a Kindle book. Because it often comes up in conversation, like either a customer or, you know, it depends on where, but there's usually something that you relate to each other on, either a common challenge or something that you're both thinking about. And so saying, oh, I read a really cool book about this. Here's the title of that book in case you want to ever look it up. And then having them get an email that's like, oh, this person gifted it to you. That's cool. So I like it when we're able to do that.
Yeah, from my side, I like local gifts just because, I don't know, I guess I like supporting local businesses kind of thing. So usually when I send a gift, I go down to my local coffee shop and buy, you know, some coffee from there and send it out. Yeah, that's like my default. That's kind of what I do. If I notice that the person is like a really big fan of something in particular, you know, maybe I might try to find that specific thing kind of like that niche, like Carolyn was talking about with the books, or if I notice that they're doing something where I could actively help them at. So like I was working with a lady from the State Department a couple of weeks ago, and they were just going remote. They were starting to do a remote workforce. And I was like, oh, well, we basically wrote a book on that. Let me send you a couple of free copies for it. And that's what I sent. So that was a shameless self plug, but I think that, you know, it did help. And she was really stoked to get that for free. So yeah, coffee for default, unless you can find some kind of niche, like Carolyn mentioned, that you can kind of focus on. Jeff, so this next one is from Marta. She says, I've noticed that most companies require customer service experience. What are your thoughts on hiring customer service novices, and how important is experience in the grand theme of candidate qualifications? So when you're looking for somebody, how important is them having that customer background?
I think that Carolyn and I are on the same team here, which is that that is I've hired many novices. I think I've hired one experienced support person in terms of like they have provided email support for a SaaS software product before. I think I've hired one person. In terms of customer service newbies, those are actually pretty hard to find. Like everyone, so many people have done customer service in some way or another. I've never met anyone in an interview that I couldn't say like, give me an example of some sort of service that you've provided somebody else and what made it special and what do you wish you had done better and all that kind of stuff. And people are like, oh, I've never done that. Like, I don't think that would be that would be a really great fit. I have been lucky lately that now that I'm actually thinking through the answer, that I have hired two people recently who had done support before. And I think that they spoke the language a little bit easier. Like it was easier to talk to them about goals and where they were feedback, like what they were doing really great on, what they could improve on. Some of the people who are more novices, one of the things I've heard quite frequently is like, how do you guys do this? My eyes hurt, right? I've been staring at the computer for so long that my eyes hurt. But I've hired teachers, Apple geniuses, what did everybody else do? Coffee, like a coffee shop people.
Barista.
Yeah, or a manager of a coffee shop, right? They have like experience running a coffee shop. So I guess that those people would probably fall into newbies, but it's like all of them had that same core belief that taking really great care of a person is also good for business, and that it's not just something that you have to do, and it's not just a way to get paid. It's also a way that you make a business grow, and that you help a customer make their business grow. And that's just like, that's a huge win. So I say, if you're a newbie, don't be worried. Like, think about the service that you have done, and use that.
Carolyn, was Jeff Fry, is it basically your answer, just him saying it?
Yeah, I think that the like word that I was going to add that maybe he was reaching for was like having a heart for customer service. That's much more important than having experience supporting a web app through email. I would add that, and similarly, we've hired super experienced people who've done this exact job and people who haven't, and they've both excelled. I would add that I don't know that this job is an entry-level job. So even if you don't have to have specific like customer service over email experience, I do think that if you've never really like worked at all, this would be a really overwhelming experience. So yeah, it might be kind of, you have to be like sort of used to what it's like to have a bunch of people all involved in the same sort of general goal with a lot going on, which might be kind of tough if you've never been in this world at all. But like Jeff said, like by the people who generally reach out to us have interned and volunteered and are usually very impressive people who aren't, that's not really a concern.
Yeah, we're kind of the same way. It's so we've hired, let's see, I was managing restaurants before this job. We've hired librarians. We had a couple of librarians on the staff, apartment managers, like apartment complex managers, Apple geniuses. And every time I hear Apple genius, I still think of like a guy standing in an apple orchard with an apple being like, yeah, this is a really good apple. but yeah, I mean, across the spectrum, as long as you've interacted with customers before and you've done so in a way that helped the customer and helped the company, I mean, that's what we're looking for. Yeah, other than that, there's not a lot of like specific like customer service based qualifications that we look for.
I think that the having a ton of customer service experience might actually be not that it's a problem, but I wouldn't value that over someone who was brand new, but when I got to know them, I totally got where they were coming from, and they had that heart, like Carolyn was saying. Because we have had plenty of people apply who are super experienced, like 10 to 15 years of support experience, and they don't have the heart for it anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? It's hard to say what they did a long time ago, but they don't anymore. And they're also very like, yeah, I have my process. This is my process. This is how I do it. Let me show you. Like, I think you should do it this way. And I love all that feedback, but we also need to have somebody who, like Carolyn was saying, is like down to sit in this vagueness pit that we have and kind of help us figure it out together, rather than just saying, I don't care about any of you guys figuring that out. I'm going to do my process because I've been doing it for forever. So yeah, all things that you just have to think about where your company is at and where your processes are at and what you need. I think that all of that has to be considered.
I love that all of our questions are like, well, this is what we do, but again, it might work for you. It might not. It just, yeah. We like hedging our bets. All right. This is second to last question. So we still got two more, but I did want to save one of these for later on just because it's one of my favorite. So from Don says, and we'll start with Carolyn on this one. Don said, we've all heard the dreaded phrase, the customer is always right, but we all know that they're wrong sometimes too. How do you handle a situation where a customer thinks they're right, but they're not? And it's rapid fire, so you know.
Okay. My rapid fire is there's very rarely a case where the customer is wrong where, like, we didn't have anything to do with it. Like, I can't think of a situation where a customer could be wrong that we also couldn't have improved in some way. Like, a customer maybe says, like, I canceled, but sometimes people think that if they remove all of their profiles from their account, then that's the same as canceling, right? So, like, customers maybe sometimes don't have all the information, but usually that's because we didn't make it easy enough to get all that information. It's sort of hard to talk about hypothetical here, but I think I would hesitate to say that like the customer is just wrong. Mm-hmm. There's usually some way to meet in the middle there.
Jeff, what do you think? How do you handle those kind of situations?
I wish I had a really great like go-to line for this, because I feel like this is a very big question, like a very big how do I provide support type of question. I think the closest I can get is that I don't think that the customer is always factually correct, right? But their perception is always right, right? It's like their perception, and it's not really your job to, or nor is it within your ability to change their perception, right? I think that you have to, it's probably more important to make sure that someone feels heard than to tell them why they're wrong. You're more likely to win them back to the positive side if you do what Carolyn was saying, like try to extract that feedback, understand how you could be doing better next time, and also make sure that you completely restate what their version of the world was. And there's been all kinds of examples I can think of where it's like, yeah, this person is not correct about what they're saying. And you know, just in having the conversation, they discover it themselves, and then they're able to say like, oops, like I, my bad. Like, I totally get that, rather than you saying like, yeah, you're wrong. And then they're like, yeah, well, watch how wrong I am. Like, I'm going to cancel or go tell the world how terrible of a person you are. So I don't think it's our job to tell people when they're wrong. I think it's our job to just help them succeed, and that those are like two separate things.
Yeah, and I wish to, like Jeff, that I had just some magical phrase that would make this all right, because it's one of those where sometimes the customer is wrong, but at the end of the day, they're the ones that's paying your paycheck. They're the ones that are keeping your business afloat and making money and, you know, allowing you to do what you do as a job. So even if they're wrong, I think back to a situation I had at one of the restaurants I was managing where there was this huge catering order, and the person that took the order, we never figured out if it was the person that took the order that left something off the order sheet, or if the customer didn't request that on the order sheet or whatnot. The customer, of course, was understandably mad about it being left out of the order. So it's one of those where you just kind of take responsibility for it and be like, oh yeah, I looked over the order last night. I must have totally missed it. I'm sorry, but I've got it, you know, I've got it fixed. It's taken care of. Could you have pointed out in that, you know, could I have pointed out in that case that the customer was wrong? Maybe. But it wouldn't have been beneficial to anybody involved. It's one of those, I don't worry about it. Yeah, they're going to be wrong sometimes, but it's not our job to point out right and wrong and that kind of thing. It's to, like Jeff said, work toward helping them do whatever by using your product. So, all right, last question. I saved an easy one just so we can wrap things up. We'll go with Carolyn first on this one. This one is from Ray. What's the best book you've read recently? Any book, not just customer service related, any book.
Okay. I am currently reading In Defense of Food, which is a very interesting, and there's real science there too, not just like obvious stuff. I also did a shout out to the book The Martian, super entertaining. Okay, a real book, a book related to like work.
Well, how are those not real? I mean, those are real books.
Those are like pleasure books. A recent like work book, I read Let My People Go Surfing, which is by the CEO of Patagonia. And it's a really, really interesting read about sort of managing styles and also the environment. So sorry, that's three, but those are my recommendations.
All right, Jeff, what's the best book you've read recently?
Oh, this is supposed to be easy.
Yeah. I mean, just pick a book. Just randomly reach over on your desk and be like, this is the book.
Assumes that I know how to read. I really like this one. I've shouted this one out before. Is it Upside Down, Backwards? Is it?
No,
weird?
It's good. Yeah.
It's called Self-Esteem at Work by Nathaniel Brandon. I really like that one. That's great for building teams and stuff. And I just read Gary Keller's The One Thing. And that is about focus and prioritization and all the things that I'm not good at. So I really enjoyed that one. And yeah, other than that, I have no idea how to get through books. I struggle with that.
I posted a blog post today about that.
Oh, fancy.
Shameless plug.
I mean, I guess it's all on a sliding scale, because there are some people who say they read like 100 plus books in a year. I would say I'm like one book. I would say I'm two books a quarter.
That'll work. Like
every 3 months, I probably read two books. Maybe I'll get through that third book.
But that's still not bad. That's not too bad. I mean,
you know what book is really great is Titan. It's the biography of John D. Rockefeller. You're going to be reading for a while, but that book is very good.
I love how rapid fire just devolved into let's just throw it all. See how big our list can get.
Answer concisely. You've been doing this for over a year. You know we're not concise people.
Slack, and then Chase is asking me things, and then like Sherman is just going crazy in the background here. I can't. I'm terrible.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep it short and simple. The one book, the best book I've read recently that you should go out and buy or read if you haven't yet. Kathy Sierra's Badass, Making Users Awesome. Really great book. Short read. You should be able to get through it in like a weekend or so, depending on, well, in a quarter maybe for Jeff, but for the rest of us, like a weekend or so should be fine. So go out and get that. Yeah. Anything else you want to add in before we finish up the rapid fire? All right. Quiet means good.
Great
so,
questions. How about that? Do we give credit to all the people who asked awesome questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Those were pretty fantastic. So, that was one of those where sometimes I have to kind of weed through and throw out, like, I don't want to say like dumb questions because, you know.
Those are all me under pseudonyms. Those are all me just submitting anonymous questions.
But yeah, the questions this time were great. But there was no weeding or editing or curating or anything like that. It was fantastic. So yeah, if you've got questions that we haven't touched on yet, make sure to let us know. supportops.co/contact. That'll get you over to where you can send us your question. And we'll either tackle it on the next rapid fire, which we're hoping to do more often, or we'll devote a full episode for it if we need to. There's still some of these questions we got today. We're probably going to go back and do a full episode on. All right. That said, that brings us to my favorite part of each and every week with this crew. It's this week's shout outs. That was perfect. Perfect. I loved it. These are the things that are making us happy. So happy. We want to shout them out from the rooftops to let you know you should be doing this, buying this, or whatnot. So let's dive right into it. Jeff, what's your shout out for this week?
My shout out this week is for an excellent music service app, product service thing called Focus at Will. I don't know if anyone has heard of it. And I don't know where I first read it, but probably Product Hunt or something like that. But here's the concept. Fake science can help you focus better. I don't know if it's fake or not, but the science appears to say that like they're going to give you music for a certain amount of time that helps you really zone in. And I haven't found out what the science is. I haven't figured it out. But I will say that it's way better than having to create a playlist. So I say, like, classical music, 30 minutes, and there's no breaks. It's just all classical music, nothing but it for 30 minutes. And at the end, they do the little Buddhist chime, and I go get a snack.
That's some deep science.
Also, I've gained 10 pounds. But seriously.
Completely unrelated. That was just from the snow. That's all that was.
Whenever I hear a Buddhist chime now, I eat a hamburger. But I don't remember why I signed up for it, but I'm on their 30-day trial, and it works. I put my headphones on. I set the time period. It's like the Pomodoro type dealy, and I go, and it works.
And that's all we need at the end of the day. If it works, it works. That's it. Carolyn, what's your shout out this week?
Gosh, I want to shout out this Slack channel because I can't do two things at once. I'm having too much trouble reading that and paying attention, so I stopped reading that for a second. But it's super interesting. Can anybody join this?
Yeah, anybody can join. That's one of those where I'll make sure to put links and everything in the show notes about how it's invite only at the moment, just because Scott kind of didn't want it to get out of hand and grow too fast. But yeah, there's a ton. I think I saw like 100 or so people in there, as far as the list goes anyway, all from support teams, all giving great advice and there for questions and things.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. My original shout out was going to be just one of the blogs that I follow. I follow a lot of various things. And I just, for all the like tech reading, I think I may have actually shouted them out before. Oh, I just used the word actually. But it was to myself, so it doesn't count. See, I can't do two things at once. The shout out I was going to give is to ReadWrite Web, which I think does the most thoughtful and interesting evaluation of bigger technological changes. Like, I love TechCrunch for this is now out and this is out and this feature and like that kind of thing. But there's sort of bigger changes happening in the technology space. I love the way ReadWrite writes about them. So that was my shout out. But I'm going back to the Slack channel. This one's awesome.
Oh, all right. My shout out this week is actually one.
Use the word actually.
The problem with that
is that like, it's like feedback, right? We shouldn't
talk to yourself, but
So actually my shout out this week. I don't know if you would call this an article as much as it's like a short book or an essay almost. But one of the writers, and I think he worked up to co-producer or executive or something like that for Lost, put out what he calls the Lost Will and Testament. And it's 17,000 words that gives a good inside view of Lost being born, basically, you know, where they come up with the idea, they pitch the idea, they went and filmed the first pilot, and then they had to write the whole season basically while the pilot was being filmed. And it's just, it was really interesting, especially something because I'm a huge, I'm a huge J.J. Abrams fan to begin with, and to see what the writer's room looks like, especially in the early stages where it's like, do these people really know what they're doing? Are they just making it up as they go? It was just a really, really good article. I say article, it's 17,000 words, so pocket it, Instapaper, whatever, and I think it took me a couple of days to work through it. But I will say one of the best things in it, and this can be applied to whatever, but they were talking about how the writers in the room will come up with tons of good ideas enough to fill a 747. I mean, it's lots and lots of ideas. And sometimes those ideas have to die to get to the really great ideas. So I think the exact line was something like, sometimes you step over bodies of good or bad ideas to get to the really great ideas. And I think that's something that, you know, works for writing as well as, doing SaaS product stuff like we all do. Sometimes you really do have to just kind of kill off mediocre ideas to get to a really great product. So I'll put that in the show notes. Like I said, 17,000 words. Take your time with it. Digest it. It's really, really great. We'll have that and all the other show notes up, supportops.co. We'll have it up tomorrow. Yeah, Tuesday is when we usually get those posted. That was the best rapid fire we've had. And we've had two so far. So I don't want to brag or anything, but this one was at least better than the last one.
Just take that, Livingston.
I don't know if he goes back and watches episodes, but if he does, Chase, if you're listening, we miss you. So, supportops.co. That's gonna have all the things that you need for show notes, articles, all that fun stuff. And then we'll be back next week, same time, 5:30 p.m. Central on Monday. And until then, have an awesome week.